Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting.
Yeah.
Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let us do it right. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And we are going to talk about rights. We are going to be talking about workers' rights and democracy. So, yes, look forward to an information-packed program today. So we are still in under the administration of a 34-count felon, a pathological liar, and a frequent mention in the Epstein files. So we cannot conclude that this person is a pedophile, but he's certainly connected with pedophiles, and he certainly is protecting pedophiles. So that's going to mean something for this country, I think, when we find out all of the stuff, because this reaches to the highest echelons of our society. And I'm going to be exploring in my writings what that means, and of course talking about it, because when it comes to children, I do not play, and y'all know that. I do not play. And so I think everybody that has any connection with Epstein, and I'm not just talking about showing up in the files, because there's some people that show up for different reasons. So for example, Stevie Wonder showed up because he was listed as a anti-Israel person, so he didn't have anything to do with it, but his name came up in that context. So we don't want to automatically assume that everybody whose name comes up is guilty. However, some people are having triggering experiences. I really can't go through those files, not even a little bit. I've seen a couple of the photos, very compromising pictures with young people, girls, and so I really don't need to see that. So I'm dependent on other entities like the New York Times, like some of the independent sources, to go through there and help us understand how deep and wide this really goes. So just stay tuned. Yesterday, we lost a civil rights icon. Reverend Jesse Jackson made his transition. And I think it's almost appropriate that he did it during Black History Month. I know he didn't pick and choose when he would leave, but certainly now going forward, we will think about, okay, Jesse Jackson died during Black History Month. So we still got roughly a week to go, but don't let that stop you, because as we say, Black History is not a month. It is an everyday thing. And so we use that month to lift up the achievements, the inspirations that Black people have brought, not just to this country, but to the world. And so it's just been an interesting thing to go to as many of those programs as I can, because people are like peeling back so many interesting pieces of research that, like I told you last week about Bass Reeves. Bass Reeves is a Black Western brother who became the first Black sheriff in the Southwest. And the Long Ranger series, which some of y'all are too young to remember, Long Ranger, who had Kemosabe as his sidekick, who was a Native American, that series, that TV series, was patterned after a Black man, Bass Reeves. So that's one of the things I found out. So I'm always just trying to find out interesting things about Black history and what's going on. You know, there is a true attack, as we talk about Black history, on Black culture, Black history by the MAGA monsters. The latest ones was up in Philly, where they dismantled an exhibit there. Martin University, which was the only Black college in Indiana, has closed its doors. So we're seeing the objective effects of, you know, DEI and the attacks on anything Black. So this is the time for us to double down, to understand the period that we're in, and be ready to resist, and more than that, to really fight back. So without further ado, I want to introduce my guest, Kay Mills, who you had heard from before is the political director for Missouri Jobs for Justice. And she's been there for a while. And in that capacity, she's done a lot of campaigns, a lot of great things. She's worked with a number of labor unions here in the state. And so she knows this stuff. She knows legislation. She knows political direction. She knows campaigns. So she's going to help us go through some of the legislative things that are affecting not just workers, but working families in Missouri. So welcome, Kay. Welcome back, I should say.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. And new to the show is David DeRosset.
DeRosset.
Did I get it right? DeRosset. I was trying to put some French on there, but he's from Drury College, where he teaches about social movements, urbanization, medical sociology, all kind of stuff. It sounds like I need to be in that class, though. But he's also on the Workers' Rights Board for the Missouri Jobs with Justice Springfield and Ozark chapter. So welcome, David.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
So I'm going to start with you, David, by asking what's going on your campus in terms of the atmosphere and environment, because as we know, the mega monsters have, you know, there's no stone they've left unturned, including the academy and higher education. What's going on with, you know, faculty there? Are the spirits high? What's going on with any kind of attacks on student groups that are, you know, expressing themselves? Are there any dismantling of some of the DEI programs on your campus? Talk a little bit about that.
Well, there have been changes, some restructuring with the programs and departments that previously were dealing with diversity, equity, and inclusion, including programs that really were designed for support for marginalized students, for first-generation students. And our student body has expressed some concern about that, although campuses in Southwest Missouri have never really been hotbeds of protest, but there has been a lot of expression of concern. I'm also the faculty advisor for our Allies student group, Drury Allies, which is an LGBTQ student group. And they've expressed enormous concern, including because of some of the restructuring that they had relied on for a lot of support. Faculty have expressed a great deal of concern. I won't say that small liberal arts colleges are entirely insulated from the executive orders and the anti-DEI push around the country, but our funding is only indirectly linked to state budgets, mostly through student aid. And so there's been at least some level of insulation, but faculty are deeply concerned. And of course, we're committed to academic freedom. And I'm in the field of sociology. There essentially is nothing I teach where the lens isn't somehow connected to diversity, equity, inclusion. We do race, class, gender in every single class. So it essentially would, if a more stringent policy were put in place that would suppress our speech in the classroom, it basically would invalidate everything I teach, the entire field of sociology. And of course, the American Sociological Association has been deeply involved in pushing back against some of the executive orders. So faculty are concerned, and we've kind of been rallying, making sure there's some level of pressure on our administration to continue to protect academic freedom. This has never really been a hotbed of protest. So we haven't seen a lot of what you might consider protest activity among students. I think there's been a little bit more at our neighboring institution, Missouri State University. They've traditionally had more student protest activity. And of course, especially since the pro-Palestinian protests in 2024, there's been a real chilling effect for student protesters on campuses, many of them who were arrested, and some of them are still dealing with legal cases. It hasn't entirely stopped student protests on campuses, but it's definitely had an effect, a chilling effect. And so we have some concern about that too.
Wow. So I'm just thinking, you said you were the advisor for the LGBTQA group. And I'm wondering, are they involved in any way with some of the anti-gay legislation in Missouri, because this state seems to be wanting to be the leader of anti-gay legislation, including when it comes to health care. So are they involved in any of that?
Well, not directly involved.
Okay.
I think they're kind of in a self-protection mode, is my impression. They've leaned heavily into trying to support each other. And we have actually quite a few local LGBTQ advocate and support organizations that have really played an important role in many cases, even with connections to the local college campuses. And so I think sometimes students are leaning fairly heavily on those organizations. And so I think their involvement is mostly taken that form.
Good, good. And my thing is whatever form it takes, that they need to be involved and understand the world that they are getting ready to like be placed in, particularly as workers, wherever that might be, and that struggle might take a different form even at that point as they become full-fledged adults with all of the responsibilities thereof. So I really want to take a point from this whole democracy thing and the protest, because one of the things that the Organization for Black Struggle and Missouri Jobs with Justice have been involved in is this whole anti-protest legislation that has really rolled across the country almost for the last decade. And so we've been working, Kay and the folks there and our allies in the state, to really push back this legislation, because I'm, you know, every time I look at a state like what's going on in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I'm thinking, what if they had some of these restrictive laws that disallow them to even assemble, like more than four people on the corner, or even this whole thing about obstructing traffic, because, and I'm sure you're going to talk about this, Kay, there's a bill going through our state legislature that allows people to be exempt from liability when they hit a protester. So, I mean, we've seen the proposed legislature take different forms, but in some states, those are law now. We've been able to like either take the teeth out of it or, you know, squash it all together. So let's start with that. But I know you put out a very comprehensive legislative update every week that's really helpful for people to follow. And I want you to tell people how they can get connected to that, because that's what helps inform me about what to be watching out for, what to tell people about. So let's start with that anti-protest thing and to give a little bit of history about that and that bill that's going through the legislature right now.
Yeah, okay, yeah, thanks, Jamala. And thanks for the kind words about our legislative update. And if folks would like to get information that, you know, to get added to our list, they can go to our website, which is mojwj.org. And I'll say that at the end too, but I just wanted to get that in there now. So yeah, you know, I feel like just kind of setting the stage for the Missouri legislative session, we are coming off of a pretty tough year for democracy in 2025. You know, we saw some politicians in the Missouri legislature repeal the paid sick time, freeze the minimum wage, send an abortion ban to the ballot directly after voters had approved it less than 6 months before. So November 2024, you know, voters approved Prop A and Amendment 3. And in May of 2025, we saw the legislature repeal those. And then in the summer, you know, we saw the Trump administration call on Governor Kehoe to rig the congressional maps in a special session. So we saw that, you know, the gerrymandered maps, we saw the attacks on the initiative petition process that are going to go to the ballot in November of this year. So, you know, at JOJ, we are starting this session like on the offensive. We are just making it so clear to legislators that we are paying attention to every vote they take, and that we are standing up and we are fighting back. And so one of those things that we are watching is, again, these attacks on the right to protest. We see these every year. We've seen them. And I know, Dave, like, I would love for you to talk about how, you know, this is part of the national trend, but we've seen them for the last, really since 2018, we've seen multiple bills filed each legislative session that would directly threaten our right to protest in Missouri. And so this year, there are three bills that we're watching. I will say the good news is that these bills haven't been assigned to committee yet. So we are watching them very closely. But House Bill 2174 would, like you said, Jamala, would remove civil and criminal liability for drivers who hit protesters. House Bill 2555 is complicated language, but it does that also. It gives legal immunity to drivers who hit protesters, and it requires protest organizers, nonprofits like Jobs of Justice that might support protests to register as lobbyists, report to the state, and it has like criminal and civil penalties for failure to do that. You have to, as part of that, you're reporting donors. So both recipients and donors would be required to file reports to the state that would be made public within a week of protest activity. They would have to include detailed data about the amount of funding involved, the funding source, the recipient, and the protest purpose. I'm not an attorney, and but I think that this seems unconstitutional. And we know for sure that its intent is to definitely to intimidate us, to discourage protest. So a really concerning bill. I think there's something similar that has been filed in Indiana as well. So again, it's just kind of the national trend of these protest laws that are making their way across the country. And then there was a third bill that was filed more recently. So House Bill 3259 would also so any participant who is involved in what they call, an unlawful or riotous assembly would be liable for property damage or personal injury caused by the assembly. So, I mean, the way that you could interpret this is even, a bystander who cheers on a protest that is later, deemed unlawful, maybe there, was some damaged property could be sued by the property owner for encouraging protest. So just, really, really terrible legislation.
And
Yeah, the thing that, go ahead, Dave.
they use the unlawful assembly language in all of these bills, and there it's defined in ways that leave the interpretation pretty wide open. But it could include something like a peace disturbance because people were being loud and boisterous. And of course, if you're involved in a protest, people tend to be loud and boisterous. That's part of the point. And so for each of these, they use that language, unlawful assembly or riotous assembly. And generally, you interpret that as an assembly of six or more people with the intent of committing a crime. But again, it could be just about anything that law enforcement interprets as a crime, including a lot of things involved in civil disobedience. So these are deeply concerning. In fact, there have been. I rely quite a bit on the International Center for Not-for-Profit Law that has a U.S. protest law tracker. And they've been tracking since 2017 across the United States. There have been about 374 anti-protest bills that have been introduced. 55 of those have been enacted. And in Missouri, there have been 23 introduced since 20 since in that same time period. I think the first ones were in 2020. And just in general, these are really designed to suppress and, in many instances, criminalize dissent. I mean, that clearly is the intent, and it certainly will be the effect. In among those 23 bills that have been proposed in the state of Missouri, two of those have been enacted. There are the three proposed that Kay just referred to. There are two others that were passed, but ultimately the language was removed that really was targeting protesters. And one of the two bills that was enacted and is on the books was one that would have prohibited strikes and picketing by public employees. And that one was found unconstitutional in 2020. So it's not currently being enforced. But I think the evidence is quite clear. Missouri legislators are doing everything they can to prevent public expressions of dissent. And I think at this moment, it's pretty clear why they're so focused on that.
Dave, are you seeing in other states these bills are like the immunity for drivers who hit protesters? Have those passed in other states? Is that law?
I'm not familiar with any of those having passed, but they're proposed in a number of states. I mean, among those 374 bills that have been introduced since 2017, These have been introduced in about 45 states. So almost every state in the country has a legislature that has introduced some kind of anti-protest bill in the last decade. And there have been other states that have taken up this issue of giving civil and criminal immunity, essentially, to people who drive into protest assemblies. Even if they result in injury or a death, they could result in a death, and they essentially would have immunity if they made the argument effectively that they were concerned for their safety. It's essentially like stand your ground laws is kind of what it boils down to. But I'm not familiar with any that have passed. It's possible, but I'm not aware.
So one of those did pass. I believe it was in Florida. And I had some of those folks on the show last year, and they said it has had a chilling effect on the ability to mobilize people. So that's the whole point. So they won on that one. And so that's why I think it's so important for us to like let people know what's going on, get them primed up to protest and protest the laws so that we don't have that. Because here's the thing that often just pisses me off. The systems of oppression will create situations that are unbearable or undemocratic, and we're supposed to be silent about that? Hell no. So we're going to protest. And then you say, now we can't protest because of X, Y, and Z. So one of the things I'm thinking, David, we'll start to see more provocateurs in these protests. Some of them will be paid provocateurs, but others might just be anarchists. But as we know, and particularly, Kay, you know, JWJ does some pulse to protest, we don't always know who's in the crowd, you know? Right. And so you got people coming in who are going to do things that you can't be, you shouldn't be responsible for. But yet and still, these laws will make you responsible for them if somebody gets hurt or some property is damaged. So to me, what did we do with that? How are we going to prove that somebody outside of our group did something that now we're liable for?
Right.
Or is that an indefensible position?
You know, one thing that's interesting to me is you're much more likely to see things like property damage during a riotous celebration after a football championship win. And those folks aren't being targeted. So it's really quite clear what the purpose of this is. You know, you mentioned Jesse Jackson. Of course, Jesse was involved with the civil rights movement when they were refining and really kind of putting into practice some of the civil disobedience tactics that we see today. And the other thing we're seeing that we haven't really talked much about yet is a kind of escalation of force style policing, where we've seen the violence from law enforcement increased pretty dramatically. And what's interesting about that is that that's essentially the tactic that was used during the civil rights movement. And because it was being broadcast nationally, where Jesse Jackson and others were being sprayed with fire hoses and beat with batons, there was a growing political will to change policing of protests. And so you got a different style that emerged in the 1970s and in the 1980s and 90s. And now we've kind of seen a return to that escalated force style of policing across the country. And it's resulting, obviously, not just in injuries, but in death. So we've got this combination of kind of a slew of anti-protest bills being introduced and many of them being enacted. And then really a ramping up of violence and brutal responses to protest activity across the country.
And do you also see what's going on in Minneapolis as the impetus for more of those kinds of bills to say, see, these people are attacking law enforcement, they can't do their job, they're obstructing. Is that going to hurt our movement around the anti-protest assemblies?
Well, I'll chime in. I think one thing that we've seen in Minneapolis is that people are countering those narratives much more effectively than they did decades ago. In part because of social media, because of the ability to video actions on the street live. You know, I think that's starting to kind of turn the national political tide to some extent. But We've seen these, what we often call frame disputes. So, coming out of the administration, they're not just calling these people criminals engaged in some kind of criminal activity, including civil disobedience. They're calling them domestic terrorists. And that's right. An entirely different legal category that opens up a significantly more possible sanctions for people who are charged with domestic terrorism, and many of which are unconstitutional. They've been declared unconstitutional in the past, but we had the Patriot Act in 2002, and that kind of opened the floodgates to those kinds of charges and to defining certain activities as domestic terrorism. But clearly what they're trying to do is discredit the protest and protesters. And, I'm hoping it kind of appears that it's not been especially effective. And we've seen a kind of turnaround in how the administration is responding to those actions. But I don't know that this is an indicator that we're on our way to major social change, particularly with regard to some of the things that are going on currently. I hope it is, but it's not entirely clear. But what I'm kind of heartened by is that people are going out into the streets regardless. They're anticipating more brutal responses from the police, and they're heading out anyway. I mean, they're taking the risk, and I think that's pretty extraordinary. Yeah. And it's it's a pretty strong symbol of what the sentiment is across the country right now.
I'm wondering, when I look at what's going on in Minneapolis, and having been there before a few times and done some stuff, whether or not that probably was the ideal state for this to happen in. Mm-hmm. And I'm just saying that because it's kind of like when the civil rights movement, the nonviolent stuff that happened in the South, that could only happen there. So it was a very, the tactics were based on the conditions. And so Minneapolis is really a different kind of animal. And the way that they responded, I think, would probably be different than any other state. And so what I see is, to your point, David, about still going out regardless of what might happen, but the way that they've organized the whole state coming in, they've trained like almost 100,000 people to be out there, to be watchers, to be filming, what to do. I mean, that's an incredible infrastructure. And so when I think about, for example, the number of phones that are on law enforcement, particularly ICE, that has really made a difference. Because prior to that, these folks would lie. I can only use that word, lie, about what happened. And just like they did with Renee, it was like, oh, she hit me with the car. Well, you weren't even in front of the damn car. So all of those angles that they were able to show, like, this is just a bold-faced lie. And so time and time again, they're having to back off of these charges, or the charges are dismissed. But don't you think that's actually having an effect on people's psyche about this whole narrative about law enforcement can do no wrong and they're here to support and protect us?
I think part of what's going on in Minneapolis is this is, not too distant from the George Floyd protests. And I think people organized at that time and developed a lot of connections that I suspect they're drawing on right now. And of course, protesters are coming from across the country. But they had this experience. And actually, that's, of course, been reported as a source of real tension between the local police and the ICE agents, because the local police have been working now since those George Floyd protests to redevelop a relationship with the community so there's more trust. And so I know that's been a struggle for them. I think clearly it's been a signal to other people across the country who are really deeply concerned about what's going on and might be interested in being more active and pushing back, but have been concerned about those risks. I mean, I think this has really been a kind of an indicator that you might be successful. I've also heard, I don't know a lot about the organizing in Minneapolis, but I keep hearing references to Lutheran grandmothers. Apparently, Lutheran mothers and grandmothers have been deeply involved in organizing some of the actions in Minneapolis. And I keep being told, you don't mess with Lutheran grandmothers. So you've got a lot of people involved.
You don't mess with grandmas, period. Yeah.
That's right. I'm always impressed when I see people at protests, including, women in their 60s and 70s and even their 80s that have those t-shirts that say, I can't believe we're still protesting this shit. Mm-hmm. But you got people of all ages that are attending and taking the risk, and they understand that under the circumstances, this is what we have. We're not being real successful in the legislature right now. And what we have are numbers and a voice. And I'm hopeful that's going to make some difference.
Yeah. Well, my listeners know that I don't give up your boat and definitely don't give up your pocketbook. Those are the three things you have some control over. And so you must remember that. So I'm thinking though, Kay, with all of the protests, which are really about democracy, maintaining, protecting, respecting this experiment called a democracy. And so when I see some of the anti-protest bills, I'm also thinking anti-democracy bills. So we've had the functionality of ballot initiatives for a while now, and we've mm-hmm. used them effectively in this state. We've had like huge coalitions that make things happen, including putting the right to affordable abortions, the right to paid sick leave, the right to Medicaid. I mean, we've done it. So these folks have seen the success of that. So now they're doing this unilateral thing about, yeah, I know the people voted for that and it was overwhelming, but we won't be doing that. And so they froze the state increase in wages. So, sometimes that could be pretty disgusting and demoralizing for voters. It's like, well, what's the point of voting? What's the point of signing those petitions? I guess that's my concern. But what I always try to tell people is that's a process. That's not the destination. So think about the 300,000 signatures that we got on this last petition. That meant 300,000 conversations we had with people. And we get to do it all over again when it gets on the ballot. So you constantly agitating and educating voters about whatever that issue is, but in the context of a democratic society. So you ticked off about four things that they just put the kibosh on. And I would add to that the taking away of local control of the St. Louis Police Department, because right. they did that all in the same yeah. legislative period. And so now we're fighting about the implications of that. So I'm just looking at there's some attempts to bring back some of this stuff. What should we be looking for those things that we've lost, or have we lost them permanently?
Yeah.
Paid sick leave.
Absolutely. Yeah. I just thinking about the initiative petition process. The first initiative petition I worked on was back in 2006, and it was to raise the minimum wage. And I think we were raising it from $5.25 to $6.50 back then. And since then, we raised the minimum wage in 2018 to $12 through the ballot initiative process, and then in 2024 to $15 just this year. So, when we think about the initiative petition process, it's a beloved process that we've used yes. on both sides of the aisle when our legislators aren't listening to us. It's how we started the Department of Conservation in Missouri. It's how we expanded Medicaid, like you said, how we repealed our abortion ban, how we protected the right to organize by defeating Right to Work, and how we are fighting back against these gerrymandered maps as well. So, we did, and I think what we saw in 2025 when the legislature in May, repealed paid sick time, like we saw who our legislators are accountable to. So we saw them accountable to their corporate donors, and we need to protect the initiative petition process because they're not doing what they need to do for working families. We also need to hold them accountable for those votes. I'm a parent, I have four kids, and I've had jobs where I've not had access to paid sick time, and it is a really, it is incredibly frustrating to have to figure out, am I gonna stay home with my kid and lose a day's wage, while I'm still paying the daycare bill too, to work. So, almost a million people in Missouri got access to paid sick time through Proposition A when we voted it in 2024. And workers did earn some paid sick time because we were able to defeat that emergency clause in the regular legislative session. So workers in Missouri did earn some paid sick time through August 28th of last year. And some workers, put pressure on employers, and some employers continued to provide it. So a little bit of good news. But like you said, like these attacks on the initiative petition process are a direct response to legislators not liking what voters are passing. They say that we don't know what we're voting for. But when you look at, the legislation, for example, we're gonna vote in November on protecting our initiative petition process, our access to direct democracy. But the way that's worded is tricky and deceptive. And they know that we love this process and that we've used it for 120 years. And the only way they, can destroy it is by tricking voters. But we're not going to let that happen. But they use the ballot candy.
No.
So it's, they talk about foreign interference, and only citizens voting, things that already, have laws governing them in Missouri. But they put that on there, and you have to read, if you look at that bill text, you have to read to like the bottom of the last page to see what it actually does, which is end majority rule and gut our initiative petition process. There are some attacks this
So
year
what that
too,
means is a
and
lot of education is going to have to go down.
they're also just trying to attack it statutorily too. We had there are bills that just make it harder to circulate initiative petitions, talk about like what type of ink you can use, what color of ink, what font size, what circulators can or can't do. And those are all like every one of those bills is just designed to make it harder to pass policy that working families support. And they try to make it easier for them to deceive voters. So there's a bill that we're watching really closely called the Let Politicians Lie Act, which allows the Secretary of State three different times to write ballot summary language. So, if he writes it and the court says, no, this is deceptive and this isn't worded right, he gets another try. The court says, no, he gets another try. So three different times, slows down the process, makes it harder for voters to know what is actually on the ballot. And the Supreme Court threw out a version of this called Senate Bill 22 last session, and just a week later, the same language was filed and it's moving through the legislature again.
So they got all kind of tricks. So David, I'm wondering, you seem to have your eye on the national trends. Is that whole thing, that initiative, ballot initiative, is that something that you see across the country?
Well, there have been attacks. Kay, do you know how many states actually have this process? Can you remember how many states? Not all states have an initiative petition process, but they've
I
been
can't
used.
remember.
In my mind, it was in the 20s,
Oh.
could be fewer than that, including in Florida. And I know there have been efforts to kind of undermine or create more barriers or even to eliminate those processes in the states where they exist, but I actually don't have all the details. I don't know where they've been successful.
I'm wondering though, for the states
Yeah.
that, yeah, that's a good piece of research, because I'm thinking about in the red states, if they don't have it, it's no big deal, because then they get to do their thing without very much opposition. But for the states where it might be a mixed bag, where you have a legislature that's blue and a governor that's red, and you have a ballot initiative process, you still have some projected success. But if it's all the stuff is stacked against you, I don't see where you go with that. And I feel sorry for folks who don't have the ballot initiative, because I know for us in Missouri, if we didn't have it, a lot of the stuff that people are enjoying right today would not be possible, because these legislators are not going to do it out of the goodness of their heart. I want to pivot a bit, Kay, to talk about some of the other things that are pushing through. People are not understanding this income tax thing that Kehoe is pushing. Can you just say a little bit about that? And David, you can chime in too, because I think that could have some severe repercussions for working families in Missouri.
Absolutely. So Governor Kehoe, in his State of the State address, said his priority this year is to eliminate the state's individual income tax. So that supports the income tax, supports about two-thirds of our general revenue budget. We already are in a huge budget deficit, like $1 billion to $2 billion already. And this proposal to eliminate the income tax would create at least a $5 billion hole in the budget. And so, what they're looking at, it sounds like, is expanding sales tax to services potentially to try to make up some of that money that they would eliminate through the income tax. But what this is really is it's a tax cut for the wealthy on the backs of working families. All of the statistics I've seen show that, if you're a wealthy person in Missouri, you might get a tax cut. But if you're someone who makes under $300,000, you're paying more. So this is not something that's going to benefit working families. It will create, it will just bankrupt our state. And we're doing it on the backs of workers.
I think it's important to note that there are tens of thousands of people in Missouri that pay relatively little income taxes because they're under the threshold, or they get returns because they overpay. So the cut doesn't actually benefit a pretty large percentage of people in the state. And moving towards sales taxes to bolster state budgets is, I mean, that's a regressive tax, as Kay was noting. Whatever those services are that end up being targeted, generally, like other sales taxes, they're things that wealthy people need access to and that poor people need access to. And if you add additional taxes to that, that clearly is going to have a more profound effect on working class families in Missouri. So we're seeing this trend across the country at the national level. We have been for years, and at the state level. And we didn't even have a deficit a couple of years ago. I mean, there was a windfall, and that's gone, and now we're in the hole, and now there's a proposal to make it even worse.
How did we get in the hole?
Well, the legislature keeps passing tax cuts for the wealthy. So, just this last year, they passed a capital gains tax break that, only benefited the ultra wealthy, but, took $500 billion, $600 million out of our budget. Wish we had a $600 billion budget, but
Not in
and
Missouri.
it's just like year after year of that, rolling back the
Here's
corporate
it.
tax.
So I'm thinking that, you got all of those people who represent different parts of Missouri. Do they not understand what that's doing for their constituents? And is that a pressure point for voters or people who say enough is this? Because part of what I always see is that people don't even know what's going on. They might feel it in their pocketbooks, but they don't know what happened. They don't know that a law was passed by people who are supposed to represent them and their best interests. And the fact that there was a balanced budget at one time, even a surplus, and now we're in the hole, and now working people are expected to pay more and shoulder the burden. I think that's a clear message that voters need to understand, but I don't know that it gets through. What can we do to help that get through in a clear, more profound way?
Well, I think you're right that I think we'll see it as this bill starts to move through the legislature, what the response is from legislators. I think especially in rural areas, people are gonna see how it's gonna impact public schools and hospitals and just key things in the communities. And we've seen that in the past where rural legislators have fought to protect public schools. So I hope that happens again this session. I haven't since it hasn't moved out of committee, I haven't heard as much conversation about it yet. But it does have to go to voters. So this is a joint resolution that the legislature would have to send to the ballot. So voters are going to have a chance to weigh in on this about whether, the average person wants to pay $500 more. The average voter in Missouri would have to pay $500 more to eliminate our income tax. So that is, a lot of, so there's gonna be a lot of political education and talking to each other, like you said, getting out, talking to each other about what we want our state to look like.
How else can we help with messaging, David? Because it seems to get drowned out by the time we start pontificating in ways that the average person, you just need to tell them how it's affecting that bottom line, their bottom line, and maybe they'll perk up and say, well, what can we do about it? But if it's all this flowery stuff, people, the message doesn't get through. And I just think that when I start talking to people, they say, well, who did that? When did that happen? Because there's nowhere where you can get all this information and could keep track of what these monsters are doing on the local, state, and federal level. That's a lot. That's a lot for the average person. That's why I thank Kay for doing that legislative update, because there's no way to be able to be tracking all that stuff and not go insane.
I think Kay would also have something to say about the avenues for political education, but your show, obviously, people who watch this show and listen to this, they're going to find out a little bit more about this. And at the very least, maybe it will alert them to start paying a little closer attention to what's happening and what the language is. I know one of the problems, of course, with all of the legal challenges to the language and some of the bills that have been proposed and that will go to voters is that we kind of have to wait for those legal changes, those legal challenges to wrap up before we can really start a concerted campaign where we can start to work a little harder to educate voters on specifics. But Kay, you probably have more to say about that. I know sometimes we schedule town halls and other events like that.
Yeah, I mean, especially as we're thinking about taxes and our budget, I always get good information from the Missouri Budget Project. They are longtime experts in our state's budget. They have, on their website, they have an analysis, several different ways to look at it with charts, and you can see where states have eliminated. That don't have an income tax, you can see how like different income groups, like what their tax rate is when you look at how much they're paying and sales and other local taxes. So it's really good research, and then we also we just really need to be talking to each other and talking to our legislators. When there's a chance, when this bill comes to the floor, we need to make sure that we are calling or emailing or going to the Capitol, sending a letter, just making sure that they hear from us, because we can't just be silent and let their story be that they only heard from people who wanted to eliminate the income tax. So.
Yeah. Well, I think all eyes will be on New York for a minute because Mayor Mamdani is talking about taxing the rich more. And there's this immediate response, well, all the rich people are going to leave New York. Well, we know that's not going to happen. But still, some people are moving their personal homes to places like Florida where there's no income tax. And so I'm thinking that Mayor Kehoe thinks this might be a refuge for those people. I'm thinking, who's really going to come to Missouri? But we don't know what's going to happen. So I think even though Mayor, this was one of his campaign promises, and now he's getting ready to implement it. So it's not like he snuck it up on people. But watching what's going to happen is going to be very interesting because I think it will have implications for other states. Wow. So, in the few minutes that we have left, what are we seeing as the greatest threats to our democracy? I know that's a big loaded question, but in your opinion, and you could take it on the local level, state level, or national level, what is the biggest threat? Because I think if we had a unified view about what that is, then we could certainly develop a strategy that deals with that very, very directly. But yeah, so go for it.
Any policies that are designed to create more barriers for citizens to be involved in political decision making are going to be of concern. And we're just seeing more and more of those around the country. And one thing I'd point out, you know, I think there's plenty of reason to be concerned about the anti-protest bills, but most social movement organizations don't immediately go to that tactic. They're often working behind the scenes. They've gone through other institutionalized approaches to bring about social change. They've been talking to legislators. They've been submitting testimony. And it's really not until they get to the point where it's quite clear that legislators aren't listening to them, that they would move to something like protest events or even an initiative petition process. So I think any attacks to, for example, those two things, or any efforts to create new barriers for voting and so on, all of those are examples of efforts to put more roadblocks in the way of people participating in our democracy. And I think in combination, you have to be concerned. I'm not sure I would point to any single one of those.
Your thoughts, Kay?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is, you know, looking at all of these different attacks and realizing, you know, why are they attacking us on so many fronts? And like recognizing that they want us divided. They want us fighting battles here. They want us pitted against each other. Because a divided working class is easier to control. So when we stay together, when we say, you know, an attack on paid sick days is a working issue, you know, an attack on abortion is a worker's issue. You know, when we attack and scapegoat trans people, that's a worker's issue. Like all of these things together are workers, working families are attacking working families, but we have to stand together.
Seems to me like we need a rainbow coalition.
Yeah.
Speaking of Jesse. And Fred Hampton.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. I also, to your point, Kate, thinking about the whole notion of wanting us to be all over the place and all these mm-hmm. different battle fronts, it can be exhausting. And that's why I'm hoping that people have some kind of umbrella that unifies us. And I think you and David have certainly said, helped us do that, because if you say, anything that working people are confronted with in terms of barriers to participation, so I'm combining what you both said, is a problem. And that way, when people see that, they can find the place where they fit. Because I think that you have to figure out where am I most passionate? Where do I feel most passionate? What's going to affect me more? That's the issue I'm going to work on. But people got to find some way to work on any one of these issues. It doesn't have to be the whole thing. That I think sometimes they get overwhelming, like all this stuff they throw in at us. I always say, pick one thing. Mm-hmm. Pick one thing. You can't save the world because it's on fire, but you know, you can certainly find something that you feel passionate about, and there's probably other people already working on that, so you just join them. So we got a lot ahead of us in 2026, particularly leading up into the midterm elections. So I really want to thank you all for coming on. And Kay, I want you to tell people where they can get that legislative update. And then I'm going to do a few announcements and then we'll close out.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having us on. So you can sign up to be a Democracy Defender on our Missouri Jobs of Justice website. And the website is mojwj.org.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jamala.
It's been... In a worker, there's going to be a couple of workers things that I want to announce. One of them is the performance of Bricks and Bible, I might have that mixed up, but this is a inspirational story about Black women workers right here in St. Louis against the Funston Nut Company during the Depression. And they were not backing down on getting their union. So please go see that. That's going to be Friday at the History Museum. The announcement is on my website, JamalaRogers.com. It is fascinating. I got a chance to see the walkthrough, the reading through, or whatever they call it, last year. And it's going to be really, you should see it. The other thing that's going to be February 21st, and I'm only doing the ones that before my next show, the Alabama Solution is about the prisons system. And this time around, at the Jubilee Community Church, they're actually going to have some of the loved ones who are featured in that documentary. So don't miss that. That's at 2 o'clock, February the 21st, at Jubilee Christian Church. And tonight, Local 420, another one of our unions here in St. Louis, will be having a summit, and I will be speaking on Team 4. If you want to know about Team 4, you got to come. It's also going to be on YouTube live stream. So that's at 6 p.m. at Vashon High School. So we got stuff about workers and democracy and the lack of democracy coming up. And last but not least, this is on the 27th, but the North Side Movement Center is going to have its opening ribbon cutting ceremony. That's Friday the 27th at 3:30 p.m. 3:30. If you can't get there at 3:30, that's fine. It's going to be going to 6:30 so that you can tour that facility. It's for us, it's for the community. It's North Side, so it's all there, y'all. So we got plenty to do to keep us pretty much active for the next week or so. So yeah, so let's do that. This again, any shows that you've missed, you want to go to jamalarogers.com. You want to, it's this going to be on YouTube in the next 24 hours, this show. So don't miss that. And we'll see you on the battlefront. This is Jamala Rogers, your host. Thank you for listening.